Hi, this is Chris from PleasureMechanics.com, and on today's episode, we are going to have a really important conversation with Kitty Stryker. Before we get started, remember that you can find our complete podcast archive at PleasureMechanics.com and go to PleasureMechanics.com/free to enroll in our free mini course so we can deliver our best advice straight to your inbox. On today's episode, we are going to be talking about creating consent culture and why consent is a vital erotic skill for all of us, even in long-term relationships. Joining us is Kitty Stryker. Kitty is an outspoken writer and professional activist. Most recently, Kitty was the editor of Ask, Building Consent Culture, a book featuring the voices of marginalized people on all of the various intersections of consent and daily life. Kitty, welcome to Speaking of Sex.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So before we dive in, I do want to give a little warning. And while we're going to focus on consent and how to build consent culture, we may also briefly touch on sexual abuse and rape. And if these subjects upset you, I encourage you to listen to this episode at a time when you can get extra support from those you love and trust. But stick with us because this is going to be an uplifting conversation that's important for all of us. So, Kitty, I was thrilled that this book included discussions of consent far beyond sex. You talk about consent in the workplace, in the doctor's office, and all of your authors contribute really unique perspectives about all of the places consent show up for us. So I do want to focus our conversation on sexual consent, but can you talk about how you laid the framework for editing this anthology and how you started thinking about consent in daily life?
Absolutely. I think that when I created this pitch, really, for the book, I thought about how many books were out there that were talking about sexual consent in particular, which is really important. But what's getting missed is that we learn these lessons about sexual consent from all the little lessons about consent we learn everywhere else. I think that one of the most popular ways to talk about this is with hugging, and how when we're a child, we're expected to hug people we don't want to because they're family, because they're a family friend, or, you know, our parents are encouraging us and sometimes demanding we give physical affection. And I think that when we have our bodily autonomy violated in that way, even though it isn't necessarily a huge dramatic violation, it teaches us that our consent doesn't matter. And as we get older, we internalize that and we see that show up in other places like the workplace where our consent doesn't matter, or we're at school and our consent doesn't matter. And of course, that's going to translate into the bedroom. So it's almost like I realized that it's a feedback loop, that the lessons we learn about consent for the bedroom influence how we act around consent everywhere else in our lives. And the way we do that then influences our behavior in the bedroom.
Yeah, it's so important. Can we just start with a really basic? So what is your working definition of consent and consent culture?
My working and sort of living document about consent is that I actually have a pithy saying that I use. If you feel that you can't say no, then your yes doesn't mean anything. Uh-huh. And I feel that that works really well. It's a relational definition of consent. And I think that that's really important because I think that consent is malleable in a lot of situations. It's infrequent that we can give 100% consent under a white supremacist capitalist patriarchy, right, which is going to be pushing us to consent to things no matter what. Living in a society pushes us to to consent under coercion often. So for me, my working definition of consent has to be a relationship wherein I think about how easy is it for someone to say no to this? And if they can say, if they can, the more that they can say no, then the more I feel they can consent.
Okay, so let's take this to the bedroom, because I love this idea that it is a relationship. And so it becomes our job not only to find our yes, no, and maybe and start working with them, but also to create the conditions that our partner can actively use their yes, no, maybe without repercussions. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So how does this look like? So I think a lot of the times when we talk about consent, people think about it in terms of hookup sex and stranger sex. And a lot of our listeners are in long-time relationships. So what does sexual consent look like for long-time partners?
Well, I mean, you know, with my one of my partners, we still ask each other if we are interested in having sex. We don't ask each other when it comes to kissing. Verbally, we don't ask each other, but we do act very mindful of body language. And there is, we constantly say no to each other, which actually feels very safe. Uh-huh. Because I feel like if my partner can say no, then I feel more comfortable when he says yes. That he knows he can say no.
And how does he say no that it doesn't feel like a rejection, but rather a refusal? Like, how do you make that not an emotionally wounding process?
I don't know that it is necessarily possible for you as the person saying no to be in control of that. Mm-hmm. I think it is the responsibility of the person hearing no to recognize that that is a trust that you are being given. So what I like to, I think Reid Mahalko says it really well, which is, thank you for taking care of yourself as a response to no. Mm-hmm. And I think that by saying thank you for taking care of yourself, or thank you for engaging in self-care, or, you know, oh, cool, thanks for letting me know, you are rewarding that person for saying no to you. And that not only works to reassure them that it's okay for them to say no, but it tells you that it's okay that someone said no to you. It means that they're taking care of themselves. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong with you.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this quote from the introduction to the book from Laurie Penny. She says, "It's not just freedom from rape, freedom from abuse, freedom from fear. It's also freedom too, freedom to express desire, to explore pleasure, to seek intimacy and adventure." Mm-hmm. That's such a beautiful concept, and the way that really actively practicing consent on both sides of the equation really frees us up to seek out more like a wider horizon for our sexuality and go beyond our comfort zone because we have this skill in our backpack.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about consent culture? So how does individual consent then play into, like, what is your vision for consent culture and how does that interact with rape culture and the discussions around rape culture?
Well, I think that with rape culture, we're talking a lot about fear and avoidance. While with consent culture, what I like to see is people talking about, well, what can we do instead? How do we make it possible for people to have more bodily autonomy, more agency, rather than less? And so the way that that manifests for me is having these conversations in different spaces. When I was asking people to review the book, I said, hey, just so you know, no is a perfectly acceptable answer. That's totally fine. I don't mind. I was just asking in case that would be something you'd be interested in. And like giving people an out, I think, is a really important part of consent culture because we have to reassure people currently that saying no isn't traumatic. Or it doesn't have to be.
I remember one time I was in the hospital with my mom, and I loved your chapter on medical consent because she was so struggling to stand up for herself. And so I negotiated it with the doctors kind of on her behalf. And she turned to me and she's like, "Where did you learn to communicate like that?" And I was like, "Well, do you remember those leather BDSM parties I started going to and you were so worried about it?" It's like I was able to translate all of the skills I developed through kinky sex into standing up for her in the hospital. And that was such a moment of learning that, like, we can pay this forward and start modeling new ways of communicating with each other.
Absolutely.
So I know that you're heavily involved in the sex scene. And is it true that you're also a submissive?
I was. I actually don't identify. I identify as kinky now, but I don't identify as a top or bottom.
Okay, so I'm curious, did you first learn about consent through your political work and then map it into your sex life? Or did it go the other way around? Like, what was your journey of learning consent?
I would say my journey of learning consent started with BDSM, where I heard people talking about safe, sane, and consensual a lot. But I don't think it deepened until I did political work around consent. And then I began to look back on my understanding of consent as it had been given to me in the kink world. And I said, wow, this is much more complicated. I have a lot of critiques about this. I don't think that the way that safe, sane, and consensual manifests in a lot of BDSM spaces is in fact consensual.
Right.
Not under my understanding of what consensual is. And so, I feel like they kind of informed each other. I don't think I would have thought about it so much had I not been within the BDSM sphere. But I also think that that BDSM sphere kind of required me to stop critiquing consent at a certain spot in order to, like, enjoy it.
And are you still involved in that community and kind of deepening that conversation now?
I dip in and out of the BDSM community now, mainly because I've found a lot of the spaces to be very resistant to recontextualizing consent, which is really unfortunate. Some of them have been really open to it, and some of them have been very dour about having these conversations. You know, it's well documented, the issues that I've had with FetLife, for example. So I think that it's possible to have a positive, to have a sex positive community that embraces ideas about consent. But I think in order to do that, you have to acknowledge where you failed and that you want to do better. And I think a lot of people are scared to do that, especially in BDSM.
And I noticed you don't use sex positive, but rather sex critical.
Yes.
Can you explain that?
Sure. So after, you know, exploring BDSM understandings of consent and then going back into political understandings of consent, I'd always identified as sex positive, but I started reading some sex negative feminists and I said, well, they're not entirely wrong with their critiques here.
Yeah.
Like, I disagree with some of the things that they say. Like, I don't think that being interested in BDSM is inherently evil. I don't think that being a trans woman is a terrible thing. But I do think that there are ways in which we ignore how patriarchy in particular, and I would add capitalism and white supremacy to that, influence our consent in a lot of unspoken ways. And I think that that was a really important layer for me to have in my understanding about consent and consent education. And so I was like, well, I mean, I could identify as sex negative. And I do occasionally identify as, like, a sex-negative pornographer, just because I think I find that entertaining. But I think sex critical is the best middle ground, and it's easiest for other people to parse.
Fascinating. Yeah. And so what is at stake here? Like, what is the transformation you're looking for? I know you're a very broad level activist who's kind of looking for a disruption of so many systems of oppression. How does this piece fit into that puzzle?
Well, I think that there's a few different ways. I think that talking about consent culture has been very important for fellow activists, talking about self-care and especially emotional labor and femme emotional labor in particular. Establishing a consent culture is really vital within activist spaces to prevent burnout, to prevent people feeling like they have to do all of the things. So there's definitely that aspect. I mean, as for what's at stake, I think our understanding of ethics, what becomes normal is at stake. You know, not to like get all political about it, but like, you know, we have a proud and blatant sexual assaulter in our White House.
Yeah.
Like, so we can see how rape culture is becoming defanged almost and treated as normal. I think that therefore consent culture has to become much fiercer and more intense in order to combat that.
And can you talk a little bit about how our systems of power complicate when we can say yes and no? So how does your subjectivity within our systems of power affect those individual moment-to-moment decisions?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that a great example is when you're at work and your boss asks you to stay late. You have the possibility of saying no, but you're not entirely sure if that is going to have immediate repercussions in a disciplinary action, because they're asking, but they're not really asking. Or if it could have long-term consequences, maybe you get looked over for a promotion down the line. So when you say, sure, I can stay late, you are thinking on some level about the ways that this could benefit or hurt you if you say no. Like, and so while technically you have consent, like you can walk out of the office, there are ways in which systems of power are in place to prevent you from feeling safe saying no.
Right. And your kind of relational power to who you're interacting with. So if you're, you know, a Black woman interacting with a white man who's your boss, like that might be a different interaction. And
absolutely,
all of these intergenerational histories come to play. And so there's a lot of talk now about white privilege and those of us with more privilege actively working with that. What is kind of one practice? I know you mentioned the beautiful practice in your communication of saying no is an okay answer. And I think that's a great actionable item for our listeners to start building into their asks. What are other ways that those of us with more power in our culture can start building safe consent culture for other people to be able to say no, to relate to us from this place of more safety?
Well, I mean, I think that no matter how much personal work you do, it does not necessarily impact other people that you're in communication with. It's a personal journey to a certain extent. So I might tell somebody no is an okay answer, but they might still feel under pressure societally, personally, to do the thing, even though I'm giving them that out. So I think that one of the most important things is to recognize that just because someone says yes does not mean that they can't change their mind about how coerced that yes was later. And this is something people find terrifying when it comes to sex, because we want it to be that we ascertained, yes, the yes is permanent. It will never change. But that's not true. It does change as we get more information. It changes as we recontextualize our interactions with each other. So by accepting that we could always be wrong and that yes, that consent is not ever 100%, we could always get it wrong, I think that it becomes vital to learn how to say, I'm sorry, I messed up. I'm sorry, I crossed a boundary. How can I help you feel safe right now? And the more we're not afraid to say that, to admit that we've messed up, to admit that we've crossed a boundary, and that we're going to take ownership of that and we're going to do something about it, I think the better for consent in general.
Mm-hmm. And it's also never too late to confront someone that you feel like violated you in whatever context. Like, I just had a really scary conversation with a doctor, which I wasn't able to have a year ago when I was really sick. But with regained health, I was able to talk to them about the ways that they had violated some of my boundaries. And that it was terrifying still, but I only could do it with my regained resources.
Absolutely. Right?
And then I learned something and kind of created a language for myself I can carry forward. So there is something about the reflection of the past. And we do hear a lot from men who are somewhat ashamed and kind of locked in a trauma because they realize now upon reflection that they had been a perpetrator of abuse in the past. Can you talk at all to that about, like, what is the forgiveness process? What is the work to be done when we realize that we've been impacted by rape culture and have become a perpetrator in some way?
I mean, I would challenge us all, including me, including you, to recognize we've been a perpetrator at some point.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps not of sexual crossing of boundaries, but we've crossed someone's boundaries.
Yeah.
We may never know who or how many people, but it's built into a white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. Like, it is the lifeblood of that to some extent. And so I think that first it's important to forgive yourself and understand that, like, you have been brought up in a very toxic environment and taught very toxic lessons and were not encouraged to get people to say no. We're not encouraged to see no as a positive thing. You know, we get fed a lot of information about rejection being the worst thing that could happen to us, or I don't know, like, that if we have crossed somebody's boundary, then we are now the worst person in existence. But I think that by recognizing that everybody crosses boundaries at some point, how do you handle it? Like, how you as an individual deal with that knowledge is really where your ethics come to the surface. So educating yourself more about consent practices is certainly one thing that you can do. Reaching out to the person that you've hurt and asking if it's okay to have a conversation about it. It might not be. They might not want to hear from you. If they've told you before that they don't want to hear from you, don't try to contact them just to, like, make yourself feel better. Sometimes it's work you're just going to have to do by yourself. But if you can make somebody or help somebody feel safer by doing some behavior or having some accountability process, sure, follow up on that and find out how you can do that. I think that we don't have very sustainable practices when it comes to dealing with consent violations. We tend to encourage people to bottle it all up. And then we banish often not only the person who is a perpetrator, but also the victim when thing when, you know, when the story comes out. And I don't think that that's sustainable because, again, that requires this really strict binary of victim and assailant.
Yeah.
That is often much more murky. A lot of people who cross other people's boundaries are victims of abuse themselves. Marginalization can play into this in various ways. So I think that banishment is most of the time not the answer. I think that trying to create a more sustainable practice of acknowledgement and education is better.
Yeah, and that can really promote accountability and give us the tools of dealing with these murky waters. One of the essays I love in this collection is The Power of Men Teaching Men by Sean Taylor. He talks about his experience of being sexually refused and how that could incite rage in him sometimes. And then how through love, which I loved, through love, he was able to learn a new perspective and help him to start to heal his toxic masculinity. So how do we motivate more men to be part of this conversation? What's in it for them?
I mean, I think that what's in it for them is not traumatizing all of the other people around them. Like, that should be enough.
Yeah.
I genuinely think that most people don't want to be toxic or to hurt other people.
Yeah.
I do think that we are taught, especially in the United States, to put ourselves above everyone else. And that we're taught, we're encouraged to be selfish. We're encouraged to trample over other people's feelings in order to achieve success, whatever that means to us. So I think that there is some work to be done around not doing that. Thinking about cooperation instead of competition is probably one of the biggest ways that men can help work on that in themselves and around the people around them.
I think most people don't feel good under those conditions. They don't feel good when they're being toxic, even if that's how they're taught to behave. And so there's a liberation in this available for all of us, and kind of a light at the end of the tunnel. Like, I think all of our culture is starting to shift to a point where we see another option. And people like you and the authors in this book are showing us the way towards a different option. I really love this book. I'm really glad you put it together. Can you tell us about the crowdsourcing campaign for the book and how people can support you?
Sure. So the book is getting published no matter what. It's getting published. Yay. Through Thorntree Press is the publisher. They're an independent publisher. The Indiegogo is the crowdfunding thing that I'm doing. That is to fund a book tour. So my hope is that I can raise enough money to take this book on a tour on the West Coast. If I make enough, then it will be an East Coast and UK tour. And part of the reason I want to do that is I want to signal boost the authors in the book and give them a chance to shine in person if they want to. And part of it is that I think that we really need to rally people to have these conversations more often. And so I want to physically go to other cities and encourage people to have these conversations and talk about, well, what is our current culture like in this particular environment? How could we do it better? How could we create more outs for people? How can we create a more sustainable accountability process?
All right. So if folks want to support the crowdsourcing campaign or find out when this book is available, go to kittystryker.com. That's KittyStryker. And we'll, of course, link that up on the podcast episode page at pleasuremechanics.com. Kitty, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.